Ukrainians so miserable they lose the will to fight and defend their country, I'm not seeing evidence that's working. After yesterday's attack, I heard anger, not fear. People are remarkably resilient in Ukraine. They've adapted to this war. A lot of homes I visit have generators. They have stockpiles of fuel. I went out for some last-minute Christmas shopping yesterday, and I saw families back out of the bomb shelters celebrating Christmas, eating dinner. But I don't want to romanticize what's happening in Ukraine. The situation here remains very hard.
Now, just before Christmas, you visited the front lines in eastern Ukraine, where the fighting is the most intense. How are things there?
Yeah, most military analysts think Russia has the advantage this winter on the battlefield. Russian troops clearly outnumber the Ukrainians. They have more artillery and shells. But Russian advances have been slow. Russia will fight for days just to take one small village, and the cost to Moscow in casualties and men killed and wounded appears to be staggeringly high. Ukraine, meanwhile, is fighting with very different tactics. They're retreating slowly, preserving as many soldiers' lives as possible. I spoke, Sarah, to dozens of Ukrainian soldiers near their front lines, and they say they're bone deep in exhaustion. They're frustrated at times by the lack of equipment, but they seem confident Ukraine's army can keep holding on.
That's NPR's Brian Mann in Kyiv. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sarah.
One of President Biden's biggest priorities in the White House was his ambitious and, some would say, controversial experiment to reshape the American economy with government subsidies and incentives. He invested hundreds of billions of dollars into certain industries, electric vehicles, semiconductors, batteries, and infrastructure. Now, as Biden leaves office, NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid has a look at this big bet to boost American manufacturing.
This was a project unprecedented in modern times, a huge infusion of government spending to reshape the economy. It's part of something experts call industrial policy. Here's the president in the fall of 2023 in Pennsylvania.
There used to be an argument that you can't have industrial policy dictated by the government. Well, guess what? I found that when the government invests in the needs of the American people, invests in America and the American people, guess what? The private sector jumps on real quick.
The idea of industrial policy had gone out of vogue in recent decades in Washington.
And while we did, the world changed.
That's Brian Deese. He was a top economic advisor to Biden in his early White House days.
And in particular, the rise of China as a ascendant global economic power who plays by a different set of rules has come to the foreground.
So the Biden team went to work openly embracing industrial policy, not just as an economic vision, but as a national security priority. They did this through a combination of carrots, like subsidies for clean energy, and sticks, like tariffs and export controls. And they made a lot of promises about the benefits. Inu Manak researches trade policy at the Council on Foreign Relations.
And one of the challenges, I think, in Biden's industrial policy is that it was trying to do too many things at once, whether it was strategic competition, creating jobs for the future, fighting climate change, or competing against China.
And economists like Christine McDaniel were skeptical that any government spending of this size could work.
Governments are not so great at picking winners and losers.
McDaniel previously worked in government and is now with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. It's a libertarian-leaning think tank. She doesn't see any sign that legislation like the Inflation Reduction Act is actually transforming the economy yet.
We have a whole bunch of history that shows us how difficult these types of industrial policies are to be effective. And so far, it doesn't look like the IRA is going to be any different. And so far, it doesn't look like the CHIPS Act is going to be any different.
But Scott Paul with the Alliance for American Manufacturing says these are changes that could take years to be felt.
A manufacturing revival is not a four-year project. It's more like a 40-year project.
And it's not clear yet what the incoming administration intends to do. Many of the projects that have been announced are in Republican-controlled districts. Here's Scott Paul again.
Politicians like nothing better than going to a factory opening or a ribbon cutting. And so I don't think that Trump or any of the Republicans are going to want their legacy to be a bunch of like half-built factories.
The Biden administration has been rushing to get funding out the door, but tens of billions of dollars from these programs have yet to be invested. During the presidential campaign, Trump specifically took aim at clean energy incentives and semiconductor subsidies.
That chip deal is so bad.
Here he was on Joe Rogan's podcast.
You didn't have to put up 10 cents. You could have done it with a series of tariffs. In other words, you tariff it so high that they will come and build their chip companies for nothing.
That CHIPS Act passed with both Republican and Democratic support. And the private sector has stepped up, too. All told, the White House says there's been more than $1 trillion of private money poured into clean energy and manufacturing projects. The president hopes that once it all takes root, it'll be hard to reverse. He talked about his legacy on the Pitchfork Economics podcast.
I think we've announced, I don't know, thousands of projects around the country for infrastructure and the CHIPS Act. But guess what? The fact is, it takes time to get them up and running.
Whether these investments actually pay off may be up for debate years after Biden leaves the White House. But one lasting legacy is that maybe the idea of industrial policy itself is no longer as taboo in Washington as it once was. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Protests erupted across Syria overnight in areas dominated by the Alawite minority after video spread of militants desecrating an Alawite shrine. Alawites are seen as having been loyal to the Assad regime, which was toppled earlier in December. And the protests, as NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Damascus, touch at the heart of a bigger crisis.
The video shared on X by Syrian activists shows militants torching parts of a sacred Alawi shrine. The new government, led by the Muslim rebel group HTS, condemned the desecration. They blamed, quote, hidden hands that sought to divide Syrians. No matter. Protests erupted in Alawite areas across Syria, and they erupted in an Alawite suburb of Damascus. We raced there, but stopped at a crossroads leading to the area. HTS gunmen are telling people to go back. A woman holding a baby flees down the hill. She says Alawites began protesting and there was gunfire. She's going to her brother's tonight. Beside them, a man stands, hesitating. He says, they told me I can't go up. There's gunfire. My son is there. He's scared. He says, I don't know whether to stay or go. We see tracer fire, like red lights shooting across the night sky, a warning, perhaps, to stay away.
A few feet away from us, there's dozens of men. They're demanding to see the interim Syrian ruler, Ahmed al-Sharaa. They are so deeply upset over the desecration of their holy shrine. And they want his word that they'll be protected in this new Syria.
One protester, Khaldun al-Adra, walks up to the gunmen. He's trying to explain the hurt Alawites are feeling, and he says, holy shrines were desecrated. An argument starts. Gunman Jawad Khawla says, when you insulted our prophets and burnt our holy books, what was that for? The protester responds, brother, we are innocent of this. We were victims too. The gunman replies, they gassed our children. He points to his gun and he tells me, I haven't even shot a bullet. I have orders. But other gunmen are spoiling for a fight. Their colleagues hold them back. And even if discipline holds here in Damascus, it's clear some militants associated with Syria's new rulers blame Alawites wholesale for the horrors of the Assad regime, and they don't see this ancient minority as part of Syria's future. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Damascus.
This is NPR News.
And this is WPR News. Thanks for being with us. It's 8:19 now on this Thursday. Well, if you're like me, there's nothing like a good walk through the park, especially, you know, after the hustle and bustle of the holidays. It's nice to kind of just break away and be with nature for a while. Well, coming up, we're going to hear from a photographer about Parks 2. That's a new book packed with photos, memorabilia, and essays about our country's national parks. That's coming up on WPR.
News coverage that keeps you informed about Wisconsin, the nation, and the world. Thought-provoking conversations that give you insight. Laughter that puts everything in perspective. The programming you value on WPR News is listener-supported. Today, make your year-end gift for the vibrant and varied service you count on and enjoy every day on Wisconsin Public Radio. Go to WPR.org/donate. And thank you.
Support for WPR comes from Welling Kitchen, Bath and Floor, and Metcalf's Market. Businesses play an important role in our communities and in funding quality news, talk, and music on WPR. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
Support for WGTD comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Benefit specialists help navigate Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other benefit programs. Their services are free and confidential. Call 262-605-6646 for more info.
Home, Wisconsin Public Radio. A winter weather advisory is in effect for some central counties in Wisconsin, lasting until noon today. There's also a dense fog advisory that's going to be lasting until 9 today in southeastern Wisconsin. The rest of the state will still see mostly clouds and some fog, with highs in the 30s and 40s today. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Imaginable Futures, celebrating the hard work, commitment, and achievements of the 1 in 5 college students who are parents. More at imaginablefutures.com. From the law firm Cooley LLP, with offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises new and established companies, investors, and financial institutions around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Art meets national parks. A new book, Parks 2, by the indie bookmaker Standards Manual, is a celebration of America's national parks and the iconic designs that went into over 300 national park maps, brochures, and other materials over more than 100 years. The volume also includes essays by fans of the parks, including photographer Brian Kelly, who joins me now to talk about this project. Hey, Brian, thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You are the collector behind this book, Parks 2. Just first of all, tell us how this project got started. How did you conceive of it?
Back in 2017, I had just completed my first book with Standards Manuals, which was a collection of New York City Transit Authority maps, brochures, just general ephemera. At the time, I had just been starting to travel around to a lot of the national parks in the United States and started collecting those maps. And then about a year and a half later, we were able to put together Parks 1. Basically, that kind of took off. And after Parks 1, you know, I still have probably about 1,200 of these maps. And so we just figured might as well try to do Parks 2 and keep it going.
I think a lot of us who've been to a national park might have collected, you know, a map or a flyer or a brochure with those classic photos of mountains and landscapes. I think a lot of people end up throwing those in the trash. What made you start collecting them?
Well, I think it was like holding on to one at a time. And so if you just have one map, it doesn't feel as significant. You might hold a memory, but then when you start getting this massive collection of them, it feels more like an archive. I feel as though a lot of these maps, especially from the early 1900s all the way up to 1965, you know, unless you were visiting these parks then, you weren't seeing these amazing designs that are just more or less non-existent in the landscape. So I really wanted to find a way to bring all these to life and let people kind of go down memory lane if they did experience them back in the day.
And a big feature of this book is not just, you know, the photos of these natural places, but also the design of some of these pieces of memorabilia. You know, that blocky font a lot of people have probably seen on national park brochures. What is it about the design that you find compelling?
Well, I feel as though with the design aspect of these maps, you go from, you know, really traditional romantic typefaces and the black and white photography, you know, all the way up to Ansel Adams. And then you have the introduction, I think, of advancements in design within the design community as far as to the design technology. And so you had this moment in the 60s where people were able to really start experimenting with new technologies. And you can see that transition happen within these maps when you start to look through them all.
Do you have a favorite place? The national park system is so vast, but as you think about everything in this collection, is there a place that's most important to you?
Yeah, I talk about it in my essay for the book, where it's probably Olympic National Park. That was the first time I had ever seen big trees in my life. And that was just something that I think kind of blew my mind. It allows you to have a pullback moment of like, I'm looking and I'm standing next to this 800 to 2000 year old tree. And like, you can't even comprehend it.
Now, these essays are another big feature of this book, sprinkled in with all of these photos of landscapes and of memorabilia that we mentioned. How did you decide who to include in this book?
It was people that I knew made a career out of the outdoors and were incredibly passionate about it. And people that I think could also like help inspire others to take interest and try to go on an adventure or try a new hobby, whether it was rock climbing or photography.
Now, Brian, before I let you go, as we look ahead to the new year, I have to ask, are there any big trips to national parks that you're planning or excited about?
I'm hopefully going to be planning a trip up to Adirondack Park. It's not a national park, but I'm hoping to get up there and photograph some of the oldest and largest eastern white pines in the country.
That's Brian Kelly, the photographer behind the new book, Parks 2. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
So I know Christmas was just yesterday and Hanukkah started last night, but buckle up because another winter holiday is just getting going. Kwanzaa is a week-long celebration of Pan-African and African-American culture that starts today and ends on January 1st. At the end, a big communal feast called Karamu is held. The holiday was created in 1966 by activist Maulana Karenga and revolves around seven principles or community values.
We've been celebrating Kwanzaa my entire life.
That's Kenya Parham. In 2022, she helped to create the first ever Kwanzaa series for the Food Network called The Kwanzaa Menu, along with her sister, Tanya Hopkins.
I joke with folks all the time that we come from a family where we've been dropping Kwanzaa banners from our house since I was born. So we are a very unapologetically proud to be Black family.
So when Tanya was asked to write an entry for Kwanzaa Foods in the Oxford Encyclopedia of Food and Drink, she was well prepared.
There were a lot of questions. People were like, are there foods associated with Kwanzaa? And it's like, yes and no. There's not like an established official thing.
Hopkins says Kwanzaa foods and traditions are diverse because Black Americans have origins in a wide variety of cultures.
Kwanzaa was a creative synthesis of harvest rituals from throughout the African continent. And Black people in America, even though we're often diminished or shrunk down or homogenized, we come from many different national origins, cultures, religions. There's food that goes with that.
For Hopkins and her sister, that means almond flour Kwanzaa cookies, black-eyed pea fritters, and iced tea made with bright red hibiscus flowers. She says there are very few rules for the holiday.
You can celebrate Kwanzaa relatively simply. You can go all in if you want, but you can also just raise a glass, pour a libation. It's not rigid.
Absolutely. And I think Kwanzaa is a little different, is inventive and creative and, you
and
know,
collective, because also, you know, there can be a burden around holidays like, oh my God, you know, where one person is expected to do their signature dishes for everybody. It's like, no, you come in there, you wash your hands, you roll up your sleeves, you work together, you prepare these things together. And I think that lessens the burden and makes it also fun and inviting and social and collective as well.
That was Tanya Hopkins and her sister Kenya Parham speaking with NPR in 2022 about Kwanzaa, which starts today. So, happy first day of Kwanzaa to all who celebrate. This is NPR.
From the U.S. presidential election to the war in Gaza, religion was a big part of many news stories this year, and the same could be in store for 2025.
I would say one of the top religion stories in 2025 will be around immigration.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We look at the biggest religion stories of the year and what we could see next year on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30, today on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is WPR News.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday, the 26th of December. It's 8:29 with news from NPR and WPR starting now.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Syria's Interior Ministry says 14 of its forces were killed in an ambush by loyalists of the former Assad regime in an area dominated by the minority Alawite community, widely seen by other Syrians as loyal to the Assads. NPR's Dia Hadid reports from Damascus.
This is among the most serious violence between Syrians since rebel forces led by Muslim group HTS overran Damascus in early December, toppling the decades-old Assad regime. The Interior Ministry said the 14 men were ambushed while, quote, performing their duties. It came after protests raged across Syria in areas dominated by Alawites, who were angered by a video that showed militants desecrating an Alawite shrine and killing the men who worked there. Facebook groups for Syrian minorities shared video that claimed to show at least some Interior Ministry gunmen in Alawite areas using slurs to refer to their community. They also shared a video of a man bleeding on the street as gunmen shout at other men. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Damascus.
People are gathering in Indonesia to remember those who died in a tsunami 20 years ago today. A 9.1 magnitude earthquake struck the Indian Ocean off the coast of the island of Sumatra, triggering a tsunami that affected a dozen countries. About 230,000 people were killed. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. A group of Wisconsin parents say the Department of Public Instruction is dragging its feet on implementing new curriculum, which aims to improve children's reading skills. Corrine Hess has more on the issue.
In 2023, lawmakers passed legislation known as Act 20. It required schools to start using a phonics-based model known as the Science of Reading beginning this school year. Parents from Decoding Dyslexia and other statewide reading groups say DPI isn't fully implementing the new law and has instead lowered reading standards. But DPI officials say the state legislature's refusal to release $50 million for the program has made it impossible to comply with the new law. Attorney General Josh Call has asked the state Supreme Court to weigh in on releasing the money. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Two former Wisconsin senators died within the past week. Tim Cullen, a Democrat from Janesville, died Monday afternoon after being hospitalized with a heart condition at the age of 80. He was first elected to the state Senate in 1974 and became majority leader in 1982. He served until 1987 when he crossed party lines to work for Republican Governor Tommy Thompson's administration. He was elected to the legislature again in 2010 and served until he retired in 2015. Former State Senator George Petak, meanwhile, died early in the morning on Tuesday at the age of 75. He was a Republican who was first elected to the state Senate in 1990. He was defeated in a 1996 recall after being the deciding vote to provide public funding to build the Milwaukee Brewers Stadium. Petak was the first state lawmaker in Wisconsin history to be removed through a recall. Milwaukee police are investigating after a child was shot on Christmas morning. The Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel reports the six-year-old was shot just before 6 yesterday morning and was taken to a nearby hospital in serious condition. An update on the child's current condition has not yet been made available. Police said they were looking into the circumstances leading up to the shooting. So far, no arrests have been made. More news available online at WPR.org. I'm Alex Crow. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Churchill Downs, presenting the 151st Kentucky Derby, dedicated to creating unforgettable memories for more than 150 years. The Kentucky Derby on Saturday, May 3rd. Learn more at KentuckyDerby.com. And from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to traceable, hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Operation Lone Star is intended to deter illegal immigration through the U.S. southern border. And over the last 3 years, Texas Governor Greg Abbott has mobilized thousands of National Guard troops to fulfill its mission. But the mobilization has taken a toll on some soldiers. At least 17 Texas National Guardsmen have died during the border mission, a number of them by suicide. Texas Public Radio's Gabriela Alcorta Solario reports.
Every month, about a dozen residents of Eagle Pass, Texas, come to this spot on the Rio Grande to pay tribute to those who have lost their lives trying to cross.
Through our prayers and through our presence here, that God will extend his touch to the families.
These vigils usually memorialize migrants, but this one also paid tribute to another group.
Even though we focus on the immigrants, but we also understand that the pressure that the National Guard people are going through, because it's not easy to see people drown.
Pastor Javier Leyva spoke next to the Eagle Pass boat ramp, where Bishop Evans, a 22-year-old National Guardsman, drowned trying to save two migrants. Evans is among at least 17 troops who have died while mobilized to Operation Lone Star. The deaths include at least 7 suicides, 2 accidental shootings, and 2 motor vehicle accidents. The Texas Military Department would not answer our questions about the deaths or the conditions of the deployment, but several Guard members agreed to talk. They requested that NPR withhold their names and distort their voices because they fear retaliation. This soldier knew Bishop Evans.
That one hurt because he was well-liked by a lot of the guys that he was on. So a lot of the guys just got really, really down from that, just losing someone you're always going to, it's never good news.
Another soldier witnessed the death of 19-year-old DeJean Towns, who died in an accidental shooting with his own personal firearm.
When we requested that we stop training because someone had died from an event that was not even supposed to have guns, we were told to shut the up, sit there, and keep doing your job as if nothing happened.
In a statement regarding the deaths, Governor Abbott's office commended the guardsmen for protecting the country from what it called the consequences of the Biden-Harris administration's dangerous open borders policy. The statement also said Abbott was proud to sign a law called the Bishop Evans Act that provides families of dead National Guardsmen a one-time payment of $500,000. But the military department told state lawmakers that of the 17 deaths, 10 claims were filed before the act was passed, while 6 were denied and deemed not mission-related. Suicide is a leading cause of death among service members as a whole, but some observers say the nature of the border mission can especially affect soldiers' mental health. Ari Sawyer, formerly with Human Rights Watch, is an expert in immigration policy.
The only way to stop these suicides is to stop forcing them to carry out these violent policies against their fellow human beings.
President-elect Trump says he plans to use the military to carry out mass deportations and secure the border. Sawyer says Operation Lone Star has shown one of the risks of that.
To the extent that the military is tasked with immigration enforcement in the United States, we will see more and more suicides, especially because, you know, like the country is really polarized on this issue. And so there's a sense of also like rejection and isolation.
The guardsman who witnessed DeJean Towns' shooting says he felt ostracized because he spoke out about how troops were treated. He eventually left Operation Lone Star after experiencing depression and PTSD.
No matter how hard I tried, it was never enough.
Because he was deployed on state orders, he did not receive disability benefits, and his conditions were deemed not service-connected. He once wanted to make the military a career, but says Operation Lone Star changed his mind. For NPR News, I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
If you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, you can call or text 3 numbers, 988, just those numbers, 988, to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. In Nigeria, the holidays are less festive this year as the country is in the grip of one of its worst economic crises in decades. The government imposed a set of controversial economic reforms that critics say have only made poverty worse. And despite recent quarters of economic growth, inflation has soared. NPR's West Africa correspondent Emmanuel Akinwotu joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
So just paint a picture for me. How difficult is the economy for people right now?
Well, for many people in the country, it's been just a brutal year. The central bank puts inflation at 34%. You know, the cost of food, energy, just basic necessities have become so expensive. And then in the last few weeks, there have been these series of shocking events that have really crystallized the struggles people are facing. Local police say about 60 people have died in 3 stampedes, different charity events around the country, where people were giving out food and cash donations. One of those events was for children in Ibadan. It's a city just outside Lagos. And thousands of people arrived there with their kids, many of them arriving a day before the event even started. But then this charity event just became a tragedy. About 35 children died. And on local media, there were these just tragic scenes of mothers weeping, looking for their children. The organizers of the Ibadan event have been arrested and have come under a lot of scrutiny, but these incidents, 3 incidents in a short space of time, have just really demonstrated the struggles people are facing.
Yeah, just an absolutely tragic example of how these economic struggles are hurting people. But what is the underlying cause of the economic situation?
Well, the government introduced a string of reforms that were largely praised by Western institutions like the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, and by the US government. But they've had a major impact on people's lives. The government devalued the currency, they cut an electricity subsidy, but really the most important one was the end of a fuel subsidy, which was one of the few benefits that Nigerians receive. Previous governments tried to end it, but they backed down because of huge protests. But it was also a really expensive subsidy for the government. And the effects of cutting it were just swift. The price of fuel soared. We just had this huge domino effect. And the price of transportation has shot up. And people rely on generators for electricity because of power cuts. So the cost of that went up too. And people expected that the subsidy might go, but they didn't think it would go as quickly as it did, especially with so little put in place by the government to soften the blow.
So, Emmanuel, what is the government doing to soften that blow that you just mentioned for the people in Nigeria?
Well, they've largely called for patience. The government says it's aware of the economic pain, but that it's necessary and temporary. They've also almost doubled the minimum wage, although in real terms, a lot of that raise has been wiped out by inflation, and they've started these cash grants, but just to the poorest people. But really, the feeling I hear day to day is this sense that the political class in Nigeria still don't truly grasp just how challenging a time things are for people.
NPR West Africa correspondent Emmanuel Akinwotu, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Alex Crow. Got about 18 minutes left in the program now. And you know, if you missed any part of our newscast at the top of the hour, you can find our stories at WPR.org. We did have a story about some small town stations who were starting to scale back here in Wisconsin. Coming up here on the show, we're going to hear about a small town daily in New York that is running its own presses and says it has no plans to scale back anytime soon. That's just ahead.
I'm Ira Flatow. On Science Friday, we wonder about the secrets of nature and meet the scientists finding the keys to the universe, like black hole maven Jan 11.
I think it's really important as a scientist not to put a belief system first. The whole point is to explore the unknown.
Come explore with us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Tomorrow at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from U.S. Venture, dedicated to having a people-first culture, with a commitment to giving back to communities locally and globally. Information is available at usventure.com. Finding a better way.
Support for WGTD's local news and public affairs commitment comes from Casey Family Options, a tradition of trust. For more information, including how to get started in pre-planning, visit caseyfamilyoptions.com or call 262-653-0667.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. Leaders in Azerbaijan have observed a nationwide day of mourning for the victims of a crash of an airplane, which killed 38 people and left 29 injured, the other survivors. Meanwhile, a possible cause of the crash has not been identified, which has led to rampant speculation. President Biden is denouncing the Christmas Day attacks launched by Russia on Ukraine. The New York Times reports more than 70 cruise and ballistic missiles and more than 100 strike drones hit across the country. In Wisconsin, a suspect accused of hitting and killing a tow truck driver along I-94 in Waukesha County on Christmas Eve has been arrested. And the Mega Millions jackpot has surpassed $1 billion after no ticket matched all six numbers drawn on Christmas Eve.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from ECMC Foundation, whose North Star is to eliminate equity gaps in post-secondary completion by 2040 so that underserved learners have greater opportunity for social and economic mobility. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Newspapers across the U.S. are cutting costs by outsourcing their printing, but one small-town paper in upstate New York is still being printed locally. North Country Public Radio's Zach Jaworski takes us there.
Just about 5,000 people call New York's Saranac Lake home. The mountain village is also home to the Adirondack Daily Enterprise, a local paper that has no plan to print anywhere but here.
There's definitely a huge sense of pride with it.
Aaron Marbone is a senior reporter for the Enterprise.
It's not something essential for journalism, but it adds a lot to journalism.
This fall, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, a regionally known outlet in Missouri, closed their press room in St. Louis, opting instead to print in Columbia, a city about 2 hours away. Dozens more make the same choice each year to cut printing costs. Marbone says keeping presses here is a tradition of sorts.
Having the press right here, finishing up the paper, and then hearing the presses kick on, it's a great feeling.
He's working on stories that don't affect a lot of people. A small road closure due to an accident and a children's musical. But to Saranac Lake, those are really important. When Marbone's done writing, he signals his newsroom colleague, who lifts a bike horn from her desk. Someone else puts their hands to their mouth and produces a loon call. Those noises let Jesse Phelan, who's been a pressman at the paper for more than 16 years, know the paper is ready to print.
All right, so everything we do here starts with paper.
Today, Phelan's walking me through the printing process, which starts out on a modern computer.
All right, so we are getting the files from our FTP site.
But after that, it doesn't look much different than it did 50 years ago.
You have to think of it in a different sense of you're in a physical media format. Actually, analog is a better term.
The massive rumarin smells like hot oil, mixed with pine, the type of tree the paper's made from. We're looking at around 50 feet of paper, bridging six refrigerator-sized printers. It looks kind of like a paper conveyor belt. These presses were made in the 1970s, and Phelan says they require a more hands-on approach than modern ones, which comes with more responsibility.
Because you're running a machine that if you make one wrong move and don't react quickly enough, you could destroy it in seconds.
Phelan wraps print rollers with aluminum templates of today's paper.
Now we apply the rest of the levers, ink feeds, compression lever. Sometimes it takes a little finesse to get this to line up. There we go.
And through that process, which looks more like a choreographed dance than a skilled trade, the Adirondack Daily Enterprise is all set to print.
You're gonna hear it for the first time.
One of the first people to read this edition, Don Reuter, a bartender at the nearby Rusty Nail.
Everyone loves local news. Everyone that works at the paper knows everyone in town, so it's kind of a nice local community.
She says it wouldn't be the same if it was printed elsewhere.
You know, everyone is wonderful at the paper, and the town enjoys having a local paper. It's something that people always grab. I pass it around every day at the bar.
As presses across the country continue to close, the Adirondack Daily Enterprise is proud to uphold a tradition. For NPR News, I'm Zach Jaworski in Saranac Lake, New York.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:49. I'm Alex Crow. Glad to have you along for this show this morning. Hey, you know, you can always find the latest news on our daily news podcast. It's called Wisconsin Today Morning News. We update it each and every weekday with our latest headlines, usually right in under about 10 minutes. Sometimes might go a little bit longer depending on the day's news. Again, that's Wisconsin Today Morning News. You'll find that wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Gregory Berg. The studios of WGTD will be closed from December 28th through January 1st for the holidays, and during that time there will be no morning show broadcast. But each and every day there will be a different morning show podcast episode for you to enjoy, with interviews drawn from the morning show archives. The podcast version of the morning show is available wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, but be sure to look for the right name, The Morning Show with Greg Berg.
It's morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In sports, a couple of Christmas Day games in the NFL yesterday. The Kansas City Chiefs beat the Pittsburgh Steelers, and the Baltimore Ravens beat the Houston Texans. The Green Bay Packers are off until Sunday afternoon when they play the Minnesota Vikings. Then they'll play the Chicago Bears to wrap up the regular season before starting the playoffs. The Milwaukee Bucks are playing against the Brooklyn Nets today. That one's going to be at home for the Bucks. Tip-off is set for right around 7 o'clock. In weather today, a dense fog advisory is just set to expire, but it's still pretty foggy right now across most of the state, and there is still a winter weather advisory in effect from Oconto and Taylor counties down to about Crawford and Dodge counties, lasting until noon today. High temperatures in the 30s and 40s today, still cloudy overnight with some freezing drizzle possible as well. This is WPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon. Tennessee is cracking down on anyone who makes threats of mass violence at a school. A state law that took effect this summer made it a felony, regardless of whether the threat is credible. But schools, law enforcement, and judges are acting on the law in different and often conflicting ways, and children are being caught in the middle. WPLN's Paige Flager and ProPublica's Aaliyah Swaby have more.
In late September, Tori was sitting down to dinner with her 11-year-old son, Junior, at Longhorn Steakhouse to celebrate a family birthday. Her phone started to ring.
I answered, and it was the officer.
The sheriff's deputy, who worked at Junior's middle school. He was looking for Junior. We're not using their full names because Junior is a minor, and this story discusses his arrest.
And I said, can you tell me what do you want? And he said, we're coming to arrest him.
In Tori's memory, everything that happened next is a blur. Junior's stepdad, Kevin, was on speakerphone. Both parents pleaded with the officer. They told him Junior is autistic. He would feel claustrophobic in the back of a cop car, especially in handcuffs.
There's no reason for you to put bracelets on an 11-year-old. He doesn't understand.
But it didn't work. Family members spilled into the parking lot. Junior's 5-year-old brother was sobbing. They watched as the officer locked Junior in the back of his patrol car. The officer arrested Junior under a new state law in Tennessee that makes it a felony to make threats of mass violence at school.
Paige and I have been investigating the consequences of this law in Tennessee. We found that school officials are forced to involve police in minor incidents they would normally handle themselves, and law enforcement is arresting kids who may not pose a real danger. So students like Junior are being handcuffed for statements that might not get them expelled. Like Junior, many children across the country who allegedly made threats of mass violence were arrested, especially after a deadly school shooting earlier this year in Georgia. Schools and police reported immediate increases in the number of school threats, many on social media, and vowed to crack down on anyone making them.
The Tennessee lawmakers who passed it told us their new law was meant to stop hoax threats. Essentially by scaring kids. Cameron Sexton, Tennessee House Speaker and the Republican sponsor of the law, said his legislation is working exactly as he intended.
Unfortunately, sometimes you have to make examples of the first few who are doing it so that others know that it's going to be taken seriously. And maybe the students will stop doing the hoax or trying to cut a joke or be funny because there's nothing funny about it.
Yet lawyers, judges, school officials, and parents criticize the law for casting too wide a net, unnecessarily traumatizing kids.
The incident that plunged Junior into the juvenile justice system happened in the last hour of the day at school. According to the police report, he overheard two other kids talking to each other. He said that one asked the other if he was going to shoot up the school. Junior looked at the other student, and he looked like he was going to say yes. So he answered for him. Junior said, yes.
The report goes on to say other kids went to the teacher and told her that Junior said he was going to shoot up the school. Junior denies ever having said that. He lives with his mom, who doesn't own guns. But under the law, that didn't matter. And it didn't matter that, according to his mom, Tori, the principal told her Junior could come to school the next day.
She said, oh, he can attend school as if he was not a threat. No hesitation, she said that.
The law doesn't require police to consider the credibility of the threat before making an arrest. And that's the department-wide mandate for officers in Hamilton County. Sheriff Austin Garrett told county commissioners that in mid-September.
We don't pick and choose. They know to make an arrest and charge the person making that threat, child or adult.
Garrett turned down our request to interview him for the story.
The Hamilton County School District investigated 38 threats from students in the first month and a half of school. Police arrested 18 kids. But school officials labeled most of the threats as low level, with no evidence of motive. The students arrested were more likely to be Black and have disabilities, like Junior, compared to the district's overall student population. Junior's school district, Hamilton County Schools, didn't respond to questions about his case and sent an email saying they try to work with law enforcement to handle threats of mass violence. Robert Filiaw is the juvenile court judge in Hamilton County, and he's seen many of these cases this year.
For example, one youngster, very young, held up a battery and called it a bomb. You know, that was enough to get him arrested.
Other students made comments about burning down the classroom or pretended to pull out imaginary guns. They were also arrested.
Law enforcement feels like they have no choice but to arrest and take them to juvenile court and then let others sort it out.
Judges like Filiaw are acting as safety nets at the end of a punitive process. And judges are rarely finding kids delinquent, which is like being found guilty in adult court. Our investigation found that about 80% of young people charged with making threats in Tennessee have been given diversion or had their charges completely dropped.
Junior's case was dismissed in juvenile court earlier this month, but the impact this has had on him hasn't gone away. He still has to sit in the same classroom with the same teacher and walk past the same officer who handcuffed him and put him in the back of a cop car. And his parents still don't know who to blame.
Do you fault the officer? Do you fault the new law? Who takes responsibility of, hey, okay, this is a massive problem and we're traumatizing our kids now?
Junior's stepdad, Kevin, doesn't know what the solution is to stop the threats in schools, but he says arresting kids like his son can't be it. For NPR News, I'm Paige Flager.
And I'm Aaliyah Swaby in East Tennessee.
As we prepare to cover a second Trump presidency, NPR is taking time to do some exit interviews with outgoing officials from the Biden administration. Tomorrow on Morning Edition, we speak with outgoing Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm. She says she's worried about what will happen to all the work done over the last 4 years to update the country's power grid.
We have added 60 gigawatts of clean power to our electric grid, which is more than double what we've ever added before because of the incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's like 30 Hoover dams worth.
Listen on your smart speaker by asking for your local NPR member station by name. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Sarah McCammon.
And I'm Alex Crow. And that'll do it for Morning Edition on this Thursday here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us, as always, this morning. News from NPR and WPR on the way.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio is provided by the Lee Ester News Fellowship, providing early career journalists the opportunity to learn hands-on reporting, editing, and broadcasting in a professional setting as part of the WPR News Department.
Support comes from the Kenosha Community Foundation, a public charity dedicated to keeping local resources local by encouraging families to begin tax-advantaged giving, strengthening nonprofits, and improving lives. Visit KenoshaFoundation.org. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD,